In our series, we're now in the book of Acts, and we're in chapter 22, where Paul's come to the end of his third missionary journey. He's come to Jerusalem, where the church elders, the church council there, had told him to join with five men who were finishing up a Nazarite vow in order to show the Jewish believers in Jerusalem that he had not abandoned the law, that he had not abandoned the traditions, that he hadn't fallen out of love with his Jewish roots. Paul obeyed their direction, and while he was in the temple, he was recognized by some of the Jews from Asia. They cried out that he was the one who was going everywhere, teaching everyone against the Jewish people, against Jerusalem, and against the temple. They accused him even of sneaking a Gentile into the temple. The entire city blew up, violently trying to kill him. And the Roman soldiers came and they arrested him and they carried him out over their heads back to the barracks because the crowds were so violently trying to reach him. Last week we saw how Paul, before going into the barracks, asked the tribune, the commander of this the Roman guard there, if he could address the mob. And so he began sharing in Hebrew to his fellow Jews his personal testimony, his witness to them, and how the Lord had called him on the road to Damascus, and how the Lord had called him to bring the gospel, bring salvation to the Gentiles. And as he said this, the Jews would not listen to another word. They wouldn't listen for another minute, and they cried out that he would be killed, away with him, take him away. Someone like this should not even live. And that's where we pick up this morning in chapter 22, verses 22. Up to this word, they listened to him. Then they raised their voices and they said, "Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live." And as they were shouting and throwing off their cloaks and flinging dust into the air, the tribune ordered him to be brought into the barracks, saying that he should be examined by flogging to find out why they were shouting against him like this. But when they had stretched him out for the whips, Paul said to the centurion who was standing by, "Is it lawful for you to flog a man who is a Roman citizen and uncondemned?" When the centurion heard this, he went to the tribune and said to him, "What are you about to do? For this man is a Roman citizen." So the tribune came and said to him, "Tell me, are you a Roman citizen?" And he said, "Yes." The tribune answered, "I bought this citizenship for a large sum." Paul said, "But I'm a citizen by birth." So those who were about to examine him withdrew from him immediately. And the tribune also was afraid, for he realized that Paul was a Roman citizen and that he had bound him. But on the next day, desiring to know the real reason why he was being accused by the Jews, he unbound him and commanded the chief of priests and all the council to meet. And he brought Paul down and he set him before them. So the Jews did not want to hear of God's salvation being given to the Gentiles. They cried out for the Roman soldiers to take Paul away. They said with loud voices, "Such a person like this should not be allowed to live." What they were basically doing was calling on the Romans to kill him. The Jews then threw off their coats. They flung dust into the air while they were angrily shouting. These are the actions of a Jewish mob who are about to stone someone. You can find this throughout the New Testament. You see this. The dust thrown into the air showing that the sins that they're accusing him of are against God. The cloaks being thrown on the ground, it shows their disgust. It shows their distress. Not only that, it helps them to better be able to go and pick up and fetch and enable them to throw stones at the transgressor that needs to be stoned. This is why in verse 24, the tribune orders him to be brought inside of the barracks. Get him inside. But he says this and he adds to it while he's still outside. And he lets not just his His soldiers understand what he's doing. He lets the crowd hear what he's saying. He basically tells them that Paul should be examined by flogging to find out why they were shouting against him like this. I think this was probably said as much to placate the mob as it was to find truth as he gave the order to his troops. But once inside, his troops stretched Paul out for the whips. Sometimes we just pass over these things because it's Paul and it happens so frequently with Paul, but Roman flogging is something that you don't just pass over. The Roman flogging whips came in one of two kinds. There were the Roman flogs with 3 leather strands, or there were the leather flogs with 9 leather strands. And one was really fast and it whipped and it ripped flesh off of bone. The other one was much thicker and harder and it would bruise and break things. And so that was the two that they would use. At the end of each of the leather strands, there were lead weights soldered onto. The weights were jagged metal shards, broken glass, anything that was jagged, they would kind of melt onto the end. So you get a picture of what these leather flogs were. To become examined back in the day by the rules meant that it would be a less than 39 lash flogging. And that was basically to get a prisoner to talk, to get a prisoner to confess. But oftentimes, if the prisoner was able to survive the flogging, they would let him go afterwards, having been examined. But often it resulted in death or great disfigurement of the person. If you remember, our Savior went through this flogging. First beaten and spat upon by the Jewish council, then flogged by the Roman troops before being delivered over for crucifixion. Something that we keep in mind as an example as we go through the message today, you're going to see some similarities in at least the thinking. So they stretch Paul out to prepare him for the whips. And there's a centurion that's standing by Paul. And Paul asked him calmly, he says, "Is it legal? Is it lawful to flog an uncondemned Roman citizen?" What I want you to see is the way in which he asks this, there's a calmness to him. Not only is there a calmness to him, there it seems almost as if he's in control. What it really seems to us, or what we really understand about Paul, is he knows who is in control. But you find in him is he asks a question, and Paul recognizes he knows what the response is going to be. The centurion immediately leaves him and goes to the tribune. And this is written in a different way here in the Greek. And you find that he's agitated. He's got a pressure. There's an urgency. And he says, "What are you about to do? This man is a Roman citizen." And you see, if you understand what that meant, and this week went in and looked a little about what did it mean to be a Roman citizen? Well, if you were a Roman citizen, you had rights, quite a few. You had the right to vote and to assemble. You had the right to run for office. You had the right to own property. You had the right to pay less taxes than everybody else who was not a Roman citizen. You had the right to never be flogged, to never be beaten, and to never in any way be tortured, unless you were being charged with treason. That was the only exception. You had the right to a trial by judge or juror, and you had the right to appeal to Caesar himself. And so you had a lot of rights. They also had a rule that anyone who would deny a Roman citizen their rights within the Roman Empire would forfeit theirs. They would receive more than what was given, and they would give up more than what was taken. That was the rule. And so these Roman rights to a Roman citizen were held in esteem. They were taken seriously. It ensured that citizens' rights were always strictly enforced. So this tribune, this commander, came to Paul as he heard this news, and he asked him if he was a citizen. And Paul replied, "Yes." The tribune answered Paul. He says, "I bought this citizenship for a large sum." And this is obviously, he came in and you could buy your citizenship in Rome. And so looking that up, there was 3 ways to gain Roman citizenship in this time. First was to be natural born. To be naturally born in Rome, or to be born in a Roman city that was a part of Rome, not just ruled by Rome. It had to have been a Roman city that had been kind of adopted by Rome as part of Rome. Tarsus, where he was from, was one of such cities that had been brought in under Augustus many years before. Second tier of a citizenship would be if you were to purchase your citizenship, and it cost about 10 years' salary. And so they roughly estimate that it would be today something worth $1 million to be able to get citizenship in Rome. So when he says, I paid a lot for my citizenship, he paid a lot for his citizenship. The third way to get Roman citizenship was to serve in the Roman guard, to serve in the Roman army for 25 years, no less. And then you were able to be a Roman citizen, and then your children would be Roman citizens. And so those were the three ways that you could become a citizen in Rome. And they were kind of tiered, top tier, firstborn, bought, or those that had come in through the military. Do you know that less than 10% of the population living in the Roman Empire were actual citizens of Rome? So it was something, and if you were a citizen in Rome, you were entitled then to wear the toga. You know, you see the pictures of the Romans with the togas. Only a Roman citizen could wear a toga. You weren't allowed to wear a toga if you weren't a Roman citizen. Tribune's name, Luke tells us, was Claudius Lysias. And if Paul had been flogged, Claudius would have forfeited his own citizenship and been flogged himself. And so he lets Paul know that he had purchased his citizenship for a large sum. No doubt more than a little upset at having almost just blown it unknowingly. And so there's a little bit of anger letting him know, do you know what you almost cost me? And there's a sense, why wouldn't you have told me this earlier? Paul said to him, but I'm a citizen by birth. Paul was a first order citizen. Paul was even authorized to wear the toga had he wanted to. It doesn't show anywhere that he did, but he could have. And because he says that he's a first order citizen, you see in verse 29, look at the reaction to this, to Paul's statement. Those who were about to examine him withdrew from him immediately. They all took a giant step back. When they heard that he was a Roman citizen, everyone in the room kind of caught their breath and took a step back from him, realizing that they'd already overstepped many of the rules, many of his rights. The tribune, we're told, was also afraid. For they all realized that they had bound a birthright Roman citizen, which was illegal without a formal charge or warrant from a preliminary hearing. Paul had rights, and here he exerts them. He exercises those rights. And so this begs a question, which is predominantly the sermon this morning, is why does Paul exert his rights as a citizen here at this time? When, if you remember in Acts chapter 16, when he's in Philippi, the magistrate took Paul from the mob, tore off his clothes, and had him beaten with rods and thrown into prison. And he doesn't say a word. He doesn't exert his rights there in that place, at least in the beginning. We'll come back to that later. But this is a question that comes up again and again for Christians. As a pastor over the last 25 years, I will tell you over and over again, people come up because they want to know. It's like, well, I have a right to do this, don't I? Can I do this? And it's a question that Christians always kind of struggle with. We see it in Jesus. We see it in Paul. Sometimes rights are laid aside and sometimes rights are exercised. This is a question that you receive often, and the results of misapplication of it are often the thing that we're actually called in to take care of as a pastor. Someone will exert their rights, and then the consequences of doing that cause discord. They cause division. They cause fights to go from little fights to big fights. But, beloved, there are times that we stand up for our rights. And there are times when we ought to lay them aside. So how do you know which is which? How do you know when to defend yourself and when not to? The other thing as we go into this question I want you to see is that we oftentimes confuse our legal rights, our lawful rights, with our moral rights. They are different. They're very different. What we are going to find as we go through this is that what you hear often is like, well, it's legal, so I can. I'll tell you that as a youth pastor for many years, that was one of the things that's like, well, you know, I can, it's legal, so if it's legal, why can't I do this? Because they kind of had all of their morality tied into to the politics, to the governments, to the laws that we're living under. And so that's what they're looking at. And so they think, well, if it's legal, I can do it. I've heard Christians in collecting debts owed to them or enforcing legal consequences on another, they sue someone because they can. And their argument is, well, I have my rights. It was my right to sue them. It was legal for me to sue them. It wouldn't be just for me to just let it go. Where's the justice in that? They're right. It wouldn't be just. That's one of the things that's hard as a pastor. You talk to someone, you go, you're right, it wouldn't be just. It would probably just be merciful. It might be a little graceful. It might even be useful. It might even be impactful for the gospel. Aren't we happy that God, in His rights, when He sent His Son, that Jesus did not hold on to His rights, that He remembered mercy as He enforces His justice? That's our God. Jesus taught us to be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. Luke 6:36. Matthew 5:38-42. Some of you are familiar. I won't turn you there at this one. We've got a lot to turn to this morning. It's the passage where we're told by our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ to turn the other cheek. When someone steals your shirt, to give him your coat also. When someone asks you to go 1 mile, you're to go 2. These are principles that we find in the Bible, that we are supposed to turn the other cheek. When someone comes at us, instead of responding in the same manner, we're supposed to respond with mercy. We're supposed to respond with grace. We're familiar with the teachings to lay aside our rights. But when to exercise them? That's the struggle. Are we just to let folks walk all over us? That's usually, after a message like this, the question that a pastor gets. So I'm supposed to just be a patsy? I'm supposed to be a doormat? Is that what we're doing? Is that how we're supposed to act? Is that what God asking us to do? When do we take a stand and make a defense? Exercise our rights. Well, these last chapters, what you're going to find with Paul, he exerts his rights no less than 5 times. Here, to the council, to the Jews, to Felix, to Festus, to Agrippa. Yet in the first half of Acts, we saw him quite frequently laying his rights aside, not worrying about what were his legal rights as much as he was watchful for what was the moral right. It wasn't what did he value, but what did God value? What did God want? Because I think this is the key to understanding this question. And so I'll kind of give you the answer up front. The key to understanding the question is, how do I know the difference? How will the action that we take affect the outcome? That's the question that you want to ask when you're faced with this dilemma. That's the question. How is this action going to affect the outcome? Is it going to bring peace? Is it going to promote the gospel? Is it going to help someone else? Is it going to glorify God? Too often, the only question that we ever ask when we're faced with these dilemmas is, how will it benefit me? What will be the value for me? What's the benefit to me? It's interesting. One of the things that I found when I was studying this week was Justice Antonin Scalia wrote this in one of his writings. He says, what is lawful is not always right. An example. We say I have a right to plead the Fifth Amendment and refuse to answer questions about possible criminal activity, even when the consequence of exercising that right may cause an innocent person to be convicted. We see there then that exercising that right is certainly wrong. It's great kind of a picture really concisely to see how you have a legal right that's actually morally wrong. I will tell you, in the church, we often see people, even Christians, exerting their rights wrongly. I'll tell you, one of the ways that I see it is in marriage counseling. First thing that the husband will tell me in marriage counseling is, I have a right to lead the home. I'm the one who's in charge of my family. I'm the one who gets to do this. And what they miss, and it's hard because, yes, you have the right, but that doesn't mean that you are to lord over your family. It doesn't mean that you're to rule with an iron fist. That's not to mean that you're supposed to rule without love. And where's the sacrifice? Where's these things? And so you kind of have the letter of the law without the understanding behind it. We see married folks with a partner who's strayed and been unfaithful. It's one of the hardest things a pastor deals with is when you're dealing with a wife whose husband has strayed. You know the question that she always asks? Do I have the right to divorce him? Yes. Yes, you do. Well, okay then. It's like, but that isn't what Jesus would like you to do. That isn't the right answer, just because, yes, you have the right to do it. Not every case, and so there's this sense that, isn't it better to reconcile? Isn't it better to forgive? Isn't it better to come back and to reestablish the vow, reestablish the covenant? Forgiveness is better. Fighting for the covenant restored, it's a good thing. Too often it's what I deserve. I think I deserve this, and I think I have the right to do this. And so the whole goal is about me. I see people going back on promises or commitments because it wasn't in writing. Well, you don't have that in writing. I hear businessmen. I work with businessmen, and they know I'm a pastor. And so one of the first things they do in business development is like, you know, I'm a Christian. I was like, good, I'll watch you closer. And you know what I find when I watch them closer? The ones who usually tell me they're a Christian are usually the ones who you got to watch, and you better get everything in writing, because they're the ones who will use some of these things. And say, well, it wasn't in writing. And the question you ask is, I thought your yes was a yes, and I thought your no was a no. Just because it's legal, it doesn't make it right. And beloved, the reason I decided to really open this up this morning is because I think that this idea of legal rights versus moral rights, right now they're this far apart, and I think we're going to see in the very near future they're going to move further and further and further apart as the secularization of our country and of our laws change. When I was a kid, pretty much there was only a couple of exceptions that things weren't legal, that weren't right. That's not the same today. So we need uncommon discernment in the days ahead to know when and when not to defend our rights. And again, I will tell you, the key lies in the result. What's the benefit of defending your rights versus the benefit of laying aside your rights? And one thing that I think is another easy way for yourself to discern between the two is to consider who benefits. And I put on here, it's like the who and the what for. What for? I'm going to defend my rights. What for? I'm going to lay aside my rights. What for? That's the question. In Genesis 13, Abraham, if you remember the story, has the right, as he's moving with Lot and his family, to take the first choice of land when he and his family arrive in Canaan. Those of you who know the story, does he take the first choice of land? No, he lays aside that right and he gives it to Lot. What for? Peace. Peace between the families. He knows that if he takes the first one forevermore, there's always going to be this sense. Part of the reason is, you know, Abraham understands that he's blessed by the Lord, and he knows that whatever he does, the Lord's going to bless and take care of him. And so he has a sense that there's going to be this animosity, this resentment always. To avoid that, you choose. He lays aside his right to keep peace. That's a good reason. Joseph, in Genesis 50, had the right to bring his brothers to justice for selling him off into slavery. He was sold off into slavery. This is relevant. Joseph was sold off into slavery, and so when his brothers come then to Egypt, think about what his brothers did. They not only sold him into slavery, they came back and told his father, who loved him, that he'd been torn to shreds by animals. Here they are in front of him. Here he is with power. Does he bring them to justice? Does he have the right? Does he have the right for justice? Does he have the right for reparations? Does he have the right for all of these things? Yes, he has the right. Does he do it? No. Turn to Genesis 50. Genesis chapter 50. Jacob has died. The brothers decide that, all right, now he's going to get us. He was nice to us as long as Jacob was alive, but now that Jacob's gone, now is when he's going to do this justice. And so that's kind of what they're thinking. They didn't know Joseph. Chapter 50, verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him." So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father gave this command before he died." It's a good idea. "Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin because they did evil to you. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father." Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers also came and they fell down before him and said, "Behold, we are your servants." But Joseph said to them, "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive, as they are today. So don't fear. I'll provide for you and your little ones." And he comforted them. And he spoke kindly to them. After you've read, this is the last section of Genesis. It's a beautiful passage, even for its placement. You know, as you kind of go through all of the things of how this everything came to be, and you get to this point, there's this uncommon grace. There's this wonderful gentleness that you see here. Joseph saw God's plan, his purposes. His heart was loving and forgiving towards his brothers. He comforted them. He was kind to them. And you know what? God was glorified. God was glorified. He did this for God. Paul had the right to be paid for his teaching and his ministry, 1 Corinthians 9. But he didn't. He worked and he paid his own way throughout all of his missions trips. For what? For who? He writes he would do anything and lay aside anything so that there would be no obstacle in the way of the gospel. He laid aside his rights for the gospel. Jesus, our Savior, our example. Turn to Matthew 26. Matthew 26. Verses 47 to 54. While he was still speaking, Judas came, one of the 12, and with him a great crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the elders of the people. You understand where we're at, right? It's the night of his betrayal, the night before the cross. And the betrayer had given them a sign saying, "The one I will kiss is the man, seize him." And he came up to Jesus at once and said, "Greetings, Rabbi," and he kissed him. Jesus said to him, "Friend, do what you came to do." Then they came up and laid hands on Jesus and seized him. And behold, one of those who were with Jesus stretched out his hand. And we know who that is, right, from another gospel. This is Peter. And he drew his sword and he struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. And look what Jesus does. He turns to him and says to him, Put your sword back into its place. All who take the sword will perish by the sword. Do you think that I can't appeal to my Father and he'll at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? But how then should the scriptures be fulfilled? It must be so. Do you see this picture? He had the right. Jesus had the power and the ability to cry out to his Father and call down legions of angels to defend him and to fight for him, to protect him. But he laid that aside. He tells Peter, he goes, if I don't lay that aside, all that my Father has planned will be for naught. No, Peter. I have the right, I set it aside for what? Because God sent me to do what I'm about to do. Jesus laid down his defense, and he was then taken by the Jews to be handed over to the Romans. And then, even more importantly, Jesus laid down his right to justice, sinless, no guilt at all, and he allows himself to be crucified. Innocent, not guilty of any sin or crime, yet without a word, not a word he said. He did not defend himself in any place. For what? Turn to 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 2. First Peter 2:22. He committed no sin, that's Jesus, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds, you've been healed. For you were straying like sheep, but have now returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. For what? Jesus laid down his right for what? To satisfy your debt, to pay your sin's price, that you might be saved, that you might be returned to your shepherd. He laid aside his right for what? For us. But Paul, here in Acts, is defending his right. And you're going to see that he's going to be defending his right in the next five chapters. Even though he had been flogged and imprisoned in Philippi, and he laid aside his right in order, you know, with the flogging, later the authorities wanted him to go quietly away. Do you remember? All right, we made a mistake. Why don't you just leave the city and get out of here, and we'll all call it even. And Paul goes, oh, no. No, I'm going to exert my right. You need to come and get me out yourself. And you need to apologize. You need to come and make good. Why? Because Paul wanted to humiliate them. He wanted them to come humbly to the city. He wanted to feel good because they really hurt me last night and I'm going to get back at them. Is that why he did that? No, not at all. What do you think the result was of them having to do that with Paul? Do you think that they would cause them to be a little more careful with their justice next time? Less likely to bother this young church at Philippi? Basically, Paul had something on them. They were on notice. I have this that I can play. I have this card that I can play at any time. And all of you that did this to me with all of these witnesses, I'm just going to put that card away. And he left. Why? For the church. For the church. He knew that this would protect the church. And so back here, then, you know, we see this sometimes rightly applied today. I wanted some relevant things that I've seen just in the last few months. A lot of you know Warren Willis, one of our missionaries. And he works for a ministry that brings the gospel to high school campuses. It's really hard to get the gospel onto a high school campus these days. I can't get onto a high school campus. If the kids invited me to come and speak, it's hard for me to get on the campus to speak. But you know what? They have the right to share the gospel. They have the right to be able to form a Bible club and a prayer club. They have the right to hold a rally themselves to share the gospel. And so what Warren Willis's ministry does, he uses seminaries and they train high school students to be able to share the gospel, to organize in their school, to organize these clubs and these meetings, to be able to share the gospel. Do you know what he has on staff with his ministry? Lawyers. He's got lawyers on retainer. Do you know why? To defend their rights. Why? For the gospel. So that we can have the gospel on the campus. At least today, still, these students have the right to be able to share the gospel with their peers. And so as long as that right is there, we're going to defend those rights in order for them to be there. And we're doing it not for the students and not for us. Not because we want to show that Christianity still has power, you know, that the church still stands. And too often that's kind of our motivation, right? Is to show these guys that, you know, we still have a voice, we still have a vote. It's just to get the gospel into the campus. And so we stand on our rights to get the gospel in. Saw a movie last week. Many of you have seen the movie. Has to do with those that are standing outside of abortion clinics. They get the police called on them all the time. They get the sprinklers set on. There's constantly kind of pressure. Do you know that every single one of those long-term ministries have a team of lawyers to defend their rights to be able to stand in a public place and pray and speak the gospel, speak love? Some people abuse that right. There's some people I wish didn't have that right, you know, when you go out there. There's some folks I wish weren't there. But the believers who are there in love, the believers who are there to pray and to show love, not just to the girls who are going in the door, but to show love to the girls coming out of the door. Beloved, that's just a side note, but let me tell you, if you're going to get involved in this, too many Christians leave after the morning. It's packed in the morning as all the girls' cars are coming in. It's empty in the evening when they're going home. Because who cares about them? We should. There's a place that we stand for our rights in the right way. These are the things that are the right way to stand in defense. So back here in Acts 23, Paul exerts his Roman citizenship rights. He avoids the flogging. Is that his motivation? That looks like that's going to hurt. So I'm going to do this because I don't want the pain of that. We know Paul by now. That's not what he's afraid of. It's not what he's doing. He wants to do what? He wants to testify before the Jews. He wants to get to Rome. He's been saying that in all of his letters. He has this call to Rome. He knows he wants to get to Rome. He wants to get to Rome. And so he wants to testify before this court. He wants to testify before the council. He wants to testify before Caesar. He wants the opportunity to bring the gospel and give his testimony in Rome. God's leading him there. And so he exerts his rights so that God's plan can progress. So to put this question to rest, how do we know when to exert and defend our rights? I will tell you that Paul, in the Corinthians, the letter to the Corinthians, throughout the entire letter, in the first part of the letter, he explains he laid aside his rights as an apostle for the sake of the gospel. He then asks the Corinthians, the next chapter, the believers, to lay aside their rights to sue one another. Why? For the sake of love. He then asks husbands and wives to lay aside their personal rights over their own bodies. For what? For protection. For protection of the other. He asked the mature believers to lay aside their right to freedoms for the sakes of the weaker Christians. He lays aside his right to food and shelter, his right to make a living from the teaching for the sake of those hearing the gospel. And then in chapter 10, he admonishes them to flee from idolatry, to not live their life as their fathers did for themselves, but to live differently. And I'm running out of time, so I won't go to the passage. But in 1 Corinthians 10, it's in your bulletins. You should go read it this week. He explains kind of the motivation for why all the way through he's telling them to lay down their rights. And he says in that chapter 10, I'll summarize, there's a difference between lawful and helpful. There's a difference between legal and the things that build up. He asked a question, are you seeking your good or are you seeking the good of your neighbor? He asked, does this satisfy your conscience or oughtn't you to satisfy your neighbor's conscience? He asked them, are you consumed with what you get to do? Or are you concerned about what you might do that would cause someone else to stumble? He asked, do you do this for God's glory or your own? Do you live to give no offense to yourself? Or do you live to give no offense to anyone else for the sake of the gospel? Do you try to please everyone and everything so that the gospel would progress, that you wouldn't be in the way? Or do you just try to please yourself? He ends with, does this help or does this hurt the cause of Christ? And then at the end he says, imitate me. Not because I'm great, but because I'm imitating him. Paul exercises his Roman citizenship. The tribune and the Roman soldiers, they back off. And he exerted his citizenship for what? We finished this section right here. On the next day, desiring to know the real reason why he was being accused by the Jews, the tribune unbound him and commanded the chief priests and all the council to meet, and he brought Paul down and he set him before them. There you go, that's for what. We're going to pick it up there next week. Beloved, it's hard for us to discern when to let go of our rights and when to hold on to them. So I would challenge you this morning, look for the for what. For who? Is it for the sake of others, for the sake of grace, for the sake of Christ, for the sake of God's glory, for the sake of the gospel? Or is it just for you? We're about to come to the Lord's table today, and so I want us to consider this morning what our Savior, God's Son, laid aside. The rights that he laid aside and endured unjustly, what he took upon himself for us out of love. He laid down his life for the ungodly that we might be saved, forgiven, cleansed, made righteous, and reconciled to God. Aren't we thankful?